Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
You know, there's some lovely parts of that song. Pat Boone actually wrote the lyrics to it. I don't think he was aware of what he was saying, but nonetheless, one of the things that strikes me as being uniquely revealing, uniquely important, uniquely wonderful about the Torah prophets and Psalms when translated correctly is that they are the antithesis of religion, the antithesis of politics. They're all designed to be liberating. Yahweh's testimony, the relationship he seeks with us, is designed to set us free. Now, the religion would have you believe that the Torah is a set of laws that must be obeyed. Paul would write that the Torah enslaves. And yet the simple truth of it is it's all about liberation. Now, Yahweh even began the first of the 10 statements etched in stone and said, you know, my name is Yahweh. I led you away from bondage, from slavery, and the crucibles of human oppression. You should not have any other gods in my presence. It's all about liberation, being free. And the song constantly reinforces the freedom there is in this relationship. There's even the freedom to use a religious term. I don't really like this term very much, but the freedom to sin, the freedom to err, the freedom to be less than perfect, without any ramifications, without guilt, without consequence. It's total freedom, liberation. And there is ultimate freedom in understanding and knowing. And so that's part of it that I really like. The other is that how would we ever know that looking at the original alphabet for Hebrew, that there would be five hands in Yahweh's name? The first letter is a open hand that is stretched out, reaching down and out to us, asking for us, offering really for us to grasp hold of it. And the song says, take my hand. Well, that's what God is offering, his hand. It's not a fist to strike us down. It's an open hand reaching out and down to us, just like a father or mother would reach out to a child that they love, that they wish to pick up. It's not about bowing down to God. What a disgusting concept. It's about standing up in his presence and him doing what is necessary to lift us up so that we can stand with him. And of course, the four other hands in Yahweh's name come by way of the two hays. Two people standing up, reaching up, grasping his hand. Then it talks about walk with me. Well, isn't that the primary instruction of the covenant? Walk with me. Walk to me and become perfect. Let's take a walk together. Let's talk while we're walking. Let's go explore together. Let's just be together. Let's go do things together. There's such a joy in walking side by side with someone you love. Throughout this testimony, that's what God has offered to do for us, to walk by our side, to lift us up and walk with us, liberate us. And then the last part of that is, by my side. We're not following him. We're certainly not leading him. We're doing this together, side by side. It's a marvelous song. And guys, it's set right between Leo Kirk and JB here with us this evening. It's set right between two marvelous celebrations of the relationship. I don't know about you, fellas, but I guess really until the last few months, maybe 6 months, felt a little left out of Yom Kippurim. And I felt a little disjointed by Yom Kippurim. And let me explain both. I felt a little left out because I came to realize that the reconciliation really had nothing to do with my relationship or our relationship with Yahweh. I say that because at Pesach, Passover, we become immortal. On Matzah, we become perfect, which is unyeasted bread. On firstborn children, which is Bukkudim, the third day of that initial feast of the year, that initial party of the year, we're adopted into Yahweh's family. Well, when you're adopted into Yahweh's family, that's about as reconciled as you could be. And then on Teruah, seven sevens later, we're enriched, empowered, enlightened, liberated. So that by Teruah, the first day of the seventh month, we can share what we've come to know, both shouting out a warning to those who remain religious and political that might make them feel good, it might be real popular, but those paths estrange us from God, who is neither religious nor political, in fact despises both human institutions. Now that's followed by, and you wouldn't think that it would come in this order, a day of reconciliations. Well, why would you be reconciled after you've done all these other things? And then I came to realize it's all about us and has nothing to do with us. It has nothing to do with us in the sense that the reconciliations, and it's plural, is between Yahweh and Yehudah and Yisrael. Yehudah and Yisrael will be reunited again, but that's important. It won't be a split house of Yisrael with Yehudah. But in fact, both will be for the first time in, oh goodness, 2000.
Dode.
500 years back. Dode, 3,000 years ago. Been 3,000 years since they've been reconciled with one another and reconciled with Yahweh. And so what I say, it's not about us, and that's a generic, generalist statement. The fact is that many of us are, in fact, Yahudim and Yisrael, or Jews, ethnically. But for those of us who are grafted into the tree and the vine that is Yisrael, you'd say, well, it's not about us being reconciled with Yisrael and with Yehudah. But in a way it is, because you know that the passage we considered a week ago where it says several weeks ago, where it talks about those who wish to be in your midst, who not only choose to be to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim, and to be part of the covenant, but who choose to be among you. And of course, the among you was Yisrael, so we're choosing to be part of Yisrael. But the reason I say it's really still all about us is that Yehudim and Yisrael have not done what they should have done. They were given the opportunity to be Yahweh's witnesses to the world. And it says they rebelled against Yahweh. They created a horrid religion in defiance of Yahweh. They replaced Yahweh with Hashem, the name, and the Lord, which is Satan's title. They gave it all up. This was their opportunity. What we have done was what they should have done. And so this is all about us, and that, well, We were given the opportunity and we seized it. And so we have played a tremendous role in reuniting Yahweh with his people. And so this day is really all about us and not about us at all, in the sense that when this day is celebrated and year 6000 Yah, on October 2nd, 2033, as the sun sets in Jerusalem, we're going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Faces beaming.
Mm-hmm.
I think even a little bit proud. I think we can be proud of having made a contribution. If you can make God smile, if you've done something that brings pleasure to him and to his children, I don't think there's anything wrong with being a little bit proud. Certainly delighted.
Huh.
Yeah. And so I think we have played a role in making Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliation, possible. This is the day that Yahweh is returning. Like at 6:22 p.m. as the sun sets over the horizon in Jerusalem. I don't think anyone on earth will be able to see that, because I think the sky will be far too occluded with all of the horror man has brought upon himself with war, pestilence, and all manner of tragedy. Of course, the strike of the asteroid and supervolcanoes. It's going to be a horrible time here on earth, but in an instant it'll be over. His light will shine upon us at that time. And it'll be a grand celebration of reconciliation of Yahweh with his people. And they will look up to him and cry out and call him Yahweh for the first time in 3,000 years. Now, it leads to, and the next day on our horizon is Sukkah. Now, Sukkah is just this marvelous celebration. It's what we have come to realize is Yahweh's ultimate goal. You want to know God's desire for your life? I want to know his will for my life. His will is Sukkah. He started out.
He wants you to be there.
Yeah, he started out doing exactly what he wanted to achieve. What do you think the Garden of Eden? What do you think is the first story? Yahweh with Adam. They talked. They walked. They explored. They laughed. They camped out together in a beautiful place. That's what Yahweh wants to do. No religion, no politics, no governance, no rules. Just God and his son, Adam. And all Sukkah is a return to Eden. And Eden, of course, is the gone. Eden is the garden of great joy. It's not a cosmic killjoy. It celebrates everything that we find beautiful in life. He celebrates great food, great wine, great song, beautiful vistas and scenery, spectacular relationship. It is my view, gentlemen and ladies who are listening, that the greatest adventure in life is a relationship. Nothing is as satisfying, nothing is as rewarding as building a wonderful relationship with someone you love. And so, all Yahweh wants to do is to return to the conditions found in Eden, having fun with us. And that's what Sukkah is about, just camping out with God. So it is a marvelous time. I am always a little bit troubled, however, by this time of year, because this is considered the high holy days for Jews. And guys, I'm bothered by that for a number of reasons. I don't like the term Jew.
No, there is no.
They're not Jews.
No.
They are Yahudim, which is the plural of Yahud. Yahud means related to Yah and to relate to Yah. And they are Yisrael, which means to engage and endure with God. It's a shame that you would take two names like that, particular Yahudim, those who are related to Yah, you would exchange that marvelous name, descriptive name, empowering name, important name, for Jew. And the second thing is, holy days bugs the living tar out of me. I say bugs the living crap out of me, but I don't think I'm supposed to say that on the radio. But it bugs me. We have nothing holy about these days. And the worst part of it is that they have convoluted this such that they have misrepresented anah, which means to answer, to reply. Now that's when you're invited, kara, to a party, chag. Well, the natural thing to do, particularly if the person inviting you happens to be the creator of the universe, is to answer and offer your reply in the affirmative. And they have convoluted answer and reply, anah, as afflicted in the sense of being abased. And why in the world would God want you to abase yourself, to afflict yourself? And it's not even yourself. The word that is associated with the verb anah is nefesh.
It's nefesh.
Right. You can't deprive your soul. Your soul doesn't eat. Your soul doesn't experience pain. Your soul can't bow down. Your soul can't humble itself. It's nefesh. It's your soul. What is your soul supposed to do when invited to a party by God?
Answer and respond.
Lord.
Yeah, answer and respond. And so how could you take something so beautiful, an offer so wonderful, and twist it in such a way that you make it a high holy day where you're supposed to afflict yourself? And so, as I talk to people about it, it's frustrating, isn't it?
You know, I looked up, how do you say Happy Yom Kippurim? Because to me, I don't view Yom Kippurim anything other than reconciliation. So
right.
I'm going, and I looked up place after place after place, and they said, now you can't say this to someone who is quote-unquote Jewish, because this is the high holy days, and this is when they are going to fast and so forth, and it's very, very, very sorrowful, and on and on and on. And so I just gave up. I said, okay, forget it. Never mind. I'll just go my way regardless. That religion. Let me ask you a question. Let me ask folks a question. In Genesis 17:14, because I just pulled this off of my sheet over here for some reason, it says, by way of association, they violated and broke by creating two separate variations, by disassociating themselves from a family-oriented covenant relationship. That is really, really early in the Torah. Moshe is writing this down.
Right.
There's nothing.
There is no disassociation
anywhere. He's writing it down. So this is the most prophetic thing. And listen, we're not talking about Paul. We're talking about this very religion that develops in the form of Rabbinic Judaism.
Yeah, it's one of those places where it's really important to know the uniqueness of Hebrew, where the verb is not past tense. It's not they broke as in the past.
It's
not just saying they will break as in the future. It's not just they are breaking as in the present. It is all of those.
Yeah.
So they have broken. They are breaking. They will break. Now, Hebrew verbs are like the spirit they represent, like light, true throughout time. And that's what defines prophecy. You know, when we began this, Kirk, and you just mentioned that this is a prophetic statement, and it is, that I always looked at prophecy as a prediction of the future.
Right.
Well, that's the third right. But it's only a third right. And it really takes an understanding, an understanding of dimensions and of light and the very nature of a spiritual being and energy and the limitations that we have as 3.5 dimensions here stuck in the ordinary flow of time. It takes an appreciation of the Hebrew language where verbs are liberated in time. It takes a real thorough understanding and a proper perspective to really appreciate what all of that means to us, that prophecy, like light, like any spiritual energy-based being, was true, is true, will always be true. So prophecy, yes, is future history. Is, yeah, we're not predicting the future, but revealing in our past what will happen in our future because he has already witnessed it. Because light can see any place and time at any time. But it's also history. And this was what was so important. I guess I didn't grasp it until very late. I'm probably a slow learner. But the creation account, where the timeline is precisely 15 billion years and 6 24-hour days simultaneously because of relativity. And they're exactly the same amount of time depending on the perspective of the witness. That account that is correct from a chronological point of view, that's correct from a scientific point of view, that's correct from a temporal point of view, is prophecy. It's just the past reported in the future accurately. And it's also the present. That's why I say that prophecy is in terms of predicting future events, is only one-third correct. That's why every prophetic statement that Yahuwah shares with us has current ramifications that are essential to our lives in terms of guiding us and enlightening us and empowering us. So the teaching is all current. But he can be speaking of a past event or a future event, and it's still prophecy. Mm-hmm. That's why when we were studying the Devarim text that explains it twice in Devarim, this label Deuteronomy, Yahweh tells us how we can go about determining whether or not he inspired something or not. And you can use that test, for example, to prove that the Book of Enoch is a fraud. And it uses two verbs to highlight this. You know, one speaks using bo, which means to come to be. The other is haya, which is was, is, and will be. And it uses both so that we have this appreciation that everything that is communicated by the prophet who is speaking on behalf of Yahuwah has to have been true in the past. So all historic presentations, including the creation account, including the story of the flood, have to be precisely accurate. Present conditions have to be correctly reflected, and all designations of future events have to be precise, without a single mistake. That's why it's both high and low in that particular test. So it's really important to view light from and his witness from that perspective. So these things don't. Fellas, I'd like to jump back into the statement we were considering last week. We had come to realize that Yahweh had made a declarative statement about the Torah and the fact there's one Torah for all people. And that's what you would expect. Why would God treat people differently in the sense of, okay, for you, the instructions are you go to the Y intersection and you veer right and you follow ABC course. But for you guys over here, you come to the Y intersection and you veer left and you do an entirely different thing. Well, that kind of guidance and instruction would be inconsistent with a God who does not change, who is consistent. So we would expect it to be one Torah for everyone. And we would expect that Torah, that teaching, that guidance to be consistent for all people. So we read that and we said, well, maybe this would be a good time before we leave this chapter, since this was a chapter on an open book test on Abraham challenging Yahweh, challenging Abraham and Yitzhak to demonstrate that they actually understood the terms and conditions of the covenant. And as they demonstrated that, and something that we were asked to demonstrate as well, through this open book quiz, if you will, test throughout the Torah, it concludes by reemphasizing that the Torah is universal for all humankind and for all time. And so we say, well, let's look at some of the things that God had to say about the Torah. We turn to the mashal, word pictures, and Proverbs 4:3 was just such an interesting revelation because it actually explains this relationship between Yahweh and Yosha that the world doesn't seem to get. And it says, because I will actually come to exist, Haya, as a son. Men, to approach my kind and responsive father, and thus the only begotten and unique son by way of the mother's presence. And this is such an interesting transition in this, because what you have is Yahweh speaking to us in first person, and then the Son speaking to us in first person. And the reason that's just so insightful is that isn't Yosha nothing more, nothing less than the Word of Yahweh? And so that's exactly what is being communicated here, that they can both speak in first person simultaneously because the Son represents the Father, that is, the Word of the Father in the flesh. Because I will actually come to exist. So this is Yahweh saying, I'm going to come to exist as a Son to approach my kind and responsive Father, and he immediately transitions to the Son's perspective. And thus the only begotten and unique Son. And then by way of the Mother's presence. Now, I'm going to tell you, this mother isn't Miriam, Mary. Her presence was totally irrelevant. A mother's presence is the same mother that speaks throughout the Proverbs, the set-apart spirit, maternal manifestation of Yahweh's nature. And what it is telling those who are observant and insightful is that Yosha was just an ordinary dude. Okay, so he had an exceptional father. He was basically like us. Until one moment in the Yarden, the Jordan River, before Yahuchanan the Immerser, the spirit of Yahweh, this spiritual mother came to reside on him. And I think just more completely, more in depth and with a greater degree of power and cognizant awareness upon him than on others. And so the very Spirit of God came to reside upon him, which is what caused the human form to be a manifestation of Yahweh the Father. But it did not exist prior to that time. That's when we're told it came upon him. That's what this is saying. And now you have an insight that very few people appreciate.
Well, Yahshua already told us he was an ordinary man, so you can't get some kind of divine birth coming from that.
No,
so.
No, he was not born as the Son of God.
No.
And Miriam, Mary, did not become the mother of God nor the Queen of Heaven. That's a Babylonian myth that Yahweh finds revolting. You know, Mary is no one special, and for the Roman Catholic Church to turn her into a goddess is repulsive. And so, he will teach and guide me. Isn't that interesting? He will teach and guide me. This is Yosha speaking of Yahweh. He will teach and guide. So, at this point, Yosha is becoming what Yahweh envisions for all of us. He wants to teach and guide us. And he said to me, accept, trust, uphold, and retain my words. on your heart to facilitate good judgments, choose to focus upon and literally observe, Shamar, my instructions regarding the conditions of the relationship, and live forever. Now, we don't know a lot of what Yosha said, other than those times where he cited the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and we can read what he said in the language he said it in. But we really don't need to know what he said. We don't even need to know what he did, because we were told what he would say and what he would do in these prophetic texts. He's going to uphold and retain the Yahweh's words. Now, at the time this was written, this was Proverbs, this was written by Job in 1000 BCE. At this point, very few of the prophets even existed. Shamuel existed. But apart from, and he was a contemporary of, a little older, but not much, than Job, David. So the Psalms are taking place because Job is writing them. The Proverbs are taking shape because Job is writing them. You have the Shaphat, the Judges. You have the five books of the Torah. You know, you have Shamuel. You have the beginnings of the Chronicles and Kings. That's it. And so the word of Yahweh is limited to those initial books. And it says that he is going to uphold and retain the words of Yahweh. That's why he said, do not think that I have come to annul or do away with the Torah and prophets. No, I've come to fulfill them, to honor them, to uphold them. That's what he's citing right here. And what is the purpose of that? Because these words will enhance good judgment. They will facilitate good judgment. Leb. When we read heart, we have to recognize that heart was the seat of judgment in Hebrew at this time, in this place, in this language. The liver was actually the seat of emotion. The heart was you took something to heart. It shaped your perspective, your understanding. To find your motivations, your sense of compassion and courage. Your very life was defined by love, and it was the seat of judgment, of rendering good decisions. And so that's what it means in this particular case. And so the words will facilitate good judgment. So we can make good decisions. Yahweh explains the nature of the universe, of life, of what he's seeking to achieve, of who he is, of what he's offering, of how we come to know him and engage in a relationship with him, and why we ought not succumb to the lies and ploys of religion or politics, militarism. Marvelous insights. They affect and facilitate good decision-making. Then he says, choose to focus upon and literally observe Shamar written in the call imperative so that it's subject to our free will. This is what he's saying. You should choose, but it's your choice. Call indicating genuinely, literally, choose to observe. Now, does observe mean to obey?
No.
No.
What does observe mean?
Definitely.
How does one observe?
Pay attention to.
Salmon.
Yeah.
You pay attention.
Yeah.
Right. Open your eyes. Look.
Look carefully.
It's the one thing that all animals really have in common. All animals have the ability to observe their environment and to respond to the things that they are seeing. That's what observe Shamar means. Pay attention to what's happening around you because you have the ability to respond. So observe. Focus, pay careful attention, closely examine and carefully consider my instructions regarding the conditions of the relationship. the result here? You know, so many religions want you to go through all these conditions and procedures and bowing down and confessions and the light statement to become saved. As God said, here is that living forever is a direct result of being observant regarding the terms and conditions of the covenant. You know, Paul wrote that the Torah can't save. God makes the difference.
Yes.
Exactly. You want to live forever, this is the way. Now, you know, I'm going to be really clear here. Living forever is not all it's cracked up to be. Living forever can be horrible, miserable, or spectacular. And for the most part, living forever for the vast preponderance of people would be a horrible thing. And that's because most people who live forever are going to live with like-minded individuals who are overtly religious and political, and there's an eternal prison for them. No torture, it's just that they'll be forever associated with like-minded people and shield. So living forever isn't all it's cracked up to be unless you've made your decisions, you've responded based upon what you've come to learn by being observant, paying attention to Yahweh's words, to upholding them, trusting them, accepting them. And then you can live forever, and it's a really good thing, because now living forever means that we forever get to be like the Garden of Eden, where we get to communicate with, talk to, and walk with, be lifted up by the very creator of the universe. Do you guys have anything you want to add to Proverbs, Mashallah 4:4?
Well, only that it's said multiple times. I mean, this is not the first time you see that sequence of words of life is a result, eternal life with him and his family as a result of your observing the mitzvah. I don't know how many times you can say it before it dims in, or how many times you're saying it still doesn't dim in to so many people. He speaks so clearly. You can't even twist these words around. I mean, you can twist the Torah around if you call it law, but then if you study it, you say that can't possibly be. You can say shamar is observe, and that can't. I mean, say it's obey, and that can't possibly be in the context. And most of the time, you can't find it if you study long enough. So I don't even know how you twist it. It says it over and over. You just have to ignore it to not get it.
Yeah, to be willfully ignored.
Yeah, as I found some 20 years ago when I was writing Tea with Terrorists, that English translations of what they call the Bible, which is just a horrid term because that's based on Babel, and it means to confuse, and those translations are confusing because they're not even remotely accurate. So you've got to be careful what you're observing and be diligent. Translating it accurately. Otherwise, you will be misled. Well, this is the next passage. I'm going to just share it as was meaningful to me in this particular chapter, and then let's go back and we'll talk about it in its entirety. God makes a statement in the midst of Mashal, where it pictures Proverbs 6:23. It's really a simple statement. He says, The Torah is light, and it's the way of life. Well, that tells us a lot, doesn't it? The Torah is light. You know, light is eternal, right? A photon of light exists forever. On a photon of light, time simply exists. The past, the present, the future all exist simultaneously. We know that E equals mc squared means that energy, of which light is so enormously greater than the same amount of matter that you have to multiply matter by the square of the speed of light to get equivalency. Light is powering. Light is enlightening. Light is all about immortality. Light is what Yahweh explained. He says, you know, let there be light. You know, his creation was beginning. And he equates himself to light. Which means you can equate this. You know, if Yahweh is light, and he says he is, and Yahweh says the Torah is light, guess what? Yahweh is the Torah. The Torah is Yahweh. If Yahweh equals light, and the Torah equals light, the Torah equals Yahweh.
Well, I remember the
same concept.
No,
so it's simple.
I was just going to say, I remember the day we were talking, and I'm looking at the letters and going, the two middle letters of a four-letter word, the Torah, is or.
Yes.
Right in the middle of the Torah, there's light. So I was thinking to myself, well, where does it keep finding light out of Torah? And I'm going, boy, am I slow. But,
yes. Yeah. Or light.
Yeah.
It is the way of life. Derek J. So, light literally defines life. You know, when scientists search for life, there's two things they look for. One is liquid water, and you know, Yahweh is constantly telling us that water is the source of life and that life emerged from water. He tells us that over and over, including in the creation account. But the first thing that he created before there would be light, before there'd be life, was light. Without light, there is no life. Without energy, there is no life. And so that light, the Torah, which is light, is what leads to the way of life. The way of life is presented in the Torah. It's a very powerful statement. Now, Kirk, you reminded me that is a truncated presentation of Mashal word picture 623, and it is because remember a long time ago in a faraway kingdom we began this series of Yada Yada Radio based upon a question that was asked by William, my favorite elevator man down here in South Florida, and William had some questions about Mashal 6 and thought that, you know, Mashal 6 could be speaking of Paul in a very negative sense. And he wanted to know who the whore was that was being associated with Paul and religion in Mashal 6. And that's where we began observations for a time. Now, with 20-some-odd chapters ago, we're returning to something we found in the 6th Mashal. Let me read it as it was in the 6th Mashal, and you can take it from there. It says, it begins, that they are the ways, let's make sure I'm getting it, here it is, for indeed, the prescriptions and conditions of the relationship agreement are a lamp illuminated by olive oil, and the Torah is light. Now, it goes on from there, but Mitzvah, the prescriptions and conditions of the relationship agreement, are a lamp illuminated by olive oil, near a glistening light provided by a wick, fueled by a container of olive oil, set, symbolic of the set apart spirit. And the Torah is or. Torah, or, is light. So here, the conditions, the prescriptions of the relationship agreement are a lamp. Torah itself is light. But that's not all. That 623 continues. They are the way of lives. Now, lives is almost always plural. You know, it's not the tree of life in the Garden of Eden, in the God Eden. It's the tree of lives, plural. Why do you suppose it's lives as opposed to the life? You know, why is it Yom Kippurim, reconciliations, as opposed to Yom Kippur, which is what the rabbinical sense called this. Why is it Kippurim? And in this case, why is it Chayim lives?
He's speaking of his family. Multiples.
Well, he has one family. So that can't be why it's plural.
No. Well, there's many people.
Plural. Lots of people.
So
being alive,
physical life, and then there's
spiritual
life.
And then spiritual.
Yes.
Also.
Yeah. We have a life now. This life is wonderful. The Torah's illumination guides us in this life right now, this mortal existence we're in. It's the ultimate life, light in a dark world. So it is the light in the midst of our mortal life. And of course, the Torah is being placed inside of us for all eternity to guide us, to instruct us, to direct us, to teach us. So it is also part of our new beginning, of our restoration, of our adoption into Yahweh's family as spiritual beings. So lives. We really all have two lives, mortal and eternal. That's why I think it's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Guides us now and guides us later.
Yeah, it makes sense.
So they are the way of lives, the means to rational discourse. Boy, do I ever like that. And it's not just that. It's the means to rational discourse, which is tokakya, about being right. Musar. Well, that's music to my ears, fellas, because ultimately, God's not interested in us being good. He's interested in us being right. Dode wasn't good. Dode was right. David. That's the reason why God said he's righteous. He's right. That's why Yahweh said, I am his father, he is my son. Not because he was good, because he wasn't good, but because he was right.
But he was right.
And the light of the Torah enables rational discourse, the proper argument and logical debate, to reason, to prove, to decide, to judge, to be rational. You know, I share with people all the time that the only way that having a meaningful discussion about the thing that's the most important in the universe will resonate, will have meaning, is if you prefer reason to faith. If you prefer reason to religion. If you are rational, are you open-minded and rational? If you're open-minded and rational, these words resonate. God is presenting himself exactly as you would have expected the creator of the universe to be. He's talking to us as intelligent beings who are capable of reason, capable of knowing, capable of understanding, capable of responding in an appropriate way. He has a higher view of us than maybe we have of ourselves. But these words, the light of the Torah, is the means to rational discourse, to communicating effectively, to knowing, to understanding, to reasoning about the only thing that really matters. I mean, there's a lot of things that are wonderful, loving relationships, being a parent, succeeding in some endeavor that you have great passion for, learning, teaching, a lot of things that have merit. But ultimately, life is about the opportunity to be right about God, forming a relationship with him. And the Torah is the means to rational discourse about being right, of accurate and correct teaching, a disciplined life, self-control, of exercising good judgment. The very thing that political correctness in our political system and our religious systems would tell us, oh, don't do. You know, the last thing you want to do is, you know, to overthink this, to be discerning, to be discriminating, to be judgmental. Don't do that. Yahweh says the Torah is the means to do that.
It's interesting. I was translating the other day, and I noticed an aspect of Shemara that I'd never really caught before, and that's part of the Shemara is not just to listen and understand, or not see and understand. Or no, it was Ra'ah is what it was. It was Ra'ah, not Shemar. But it means to pay attention, look at, and observe. But it also, it carries with it this connotation of to make judgment based upon that observation.
Yes. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I keep on preferring to bring up Shemar observation in the context of animal life. It's not just to observe, but to respond to what you observe that makes animals different than plants. Yeah, it's observing with a purpose. What's the purpose in seeing the stop sign if you don't stop? What's the purpose of seeing the bridge across the stream if you don't use it? What's the purpose in finding the truth if you don't capitalize on it? What benefit is of a relationship if you don't explore it?
Interesting thing. Interesting thing that we were watching a program on children and how they learn. Some things that they're doing, and one of the statements that grabbed me was that they said, first of all, they have to observe the letters, the words. And then they have to, having done that, they have to say it out aloud.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to understand it. Somebody has to explain what the word means. And I thought how interesting, because when we have a festival feast, and if you did it with, in particular, these symbolic letters that he used, the pictographs, you would see the pictures. You would understand, you could see the words, you could even get rest understanding from that. But more importantly, he asked us to read and recite. If you're not reciting, at least someone's reading it, so you're hearing it as well as seeing the letters and so forth. And then the culmination being that you understand it, and that puts it into your memory base so that you connect. And they were talking about little cells running back to your cranium and different parts of your brain and how your brain works and everything. And I thought, well, that's what Yahweh does. He started out with letters, with symbolic letters, with letters that have pictures. And then he asked you to read and recite the thing. And if you, and Moshe made everybody stand up and while he read the whole thing he'd written and be alert about it. And then he has Dabarim when he's explaining it all. So I thought, just on top of his game, ain't he?
everything.
I had a conversation with someone in the forum the other day talking about, textual criticism where people, there's this whole scholarly idea now that, the Torah was written by multiple authors and they'll cite, this wording's used here and not here and spoken of this way here, but not here. I'm like, how do you explain that? I'm like, I went to school to be a teacher. I may not have ended up doing it, but I actually went through all my education programs, and one of the things they teach you is to teach the same thing over and over in different ways. Mm-hmm. So you're going to repeat yourself a lot, but you're going to do it in a different way every time, so people will be more likely to learn it. So it makes sense that Yahweh, being the ultimate teacher, would do that. He would say it in a different way, here and here. I'm like, that's even really the nature of Hebrew poetry. You say the same thing over, and then you say it a different way. So, that doesn't prove that it was written by a different author. It just proves that God knows how to teach.
That's exactly right. And the ability to take truth and to view it from the facets of a diamond, so you're reflecting the light, the same light and the same stone, but you get to see it from its various facets, just like the color, the Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, the colors of light as they're manifest in the rainbow. They all give us a little different perspective, a different
hue.
Facet. Yeah, a different hue on the same light, on the same essence. And it is by being able to communicate using different words. You know, when we do this radio program, I never, ever, well, I can't say never, ever, I very seldom will read what I wrote sometimes months, sometimes years ago, surrounding the commentary and the insights I glean from these passages. And the reason I don't do that, unless we're communicating something where, you know, boy, in that moment I was really inspired and just that it just got the essence of something in so many words that it was really important to share it as concisely as it was shared to reinforce it. The reason I don't want to do that is that the joy of learning is seeing something and responding to it as you're viewing it. Of literally shamar, of observing and then responding in the moment, staying in the moment. And what I find is that in the writing so many years ago, I would have seen an insight and shared those, and in the discussion,
you get something new.
Yeah, other additional insights. And I think that's a much better way to go about it. What it also says is that you have the confidence in what you know and understand about Yahweh and his testimony. To read something and know that it's going to resonate. To know that out of this you're going to be inspired to share something that is profound, that is insightful, that helps us all learn and grow and guide it properly. So the very way we're doing this program, mm-hmm. which is to read Yah's testimony and then expound upon it, is in fact this concept that they don't get in textual criticism, where you're saying the same thing but using different words.
Yeah.
That's how we learn. That's how we teach. This Proverbs, Mishal 6:24 does have an interesting twist, if you will. Yahweh kind of likes to show the dark and light sides of things. So if you view the Torah as a light, it's going to lead you to eternal life and to making good to decisions and to being right. Well, there's another thing that it will do. It will preclude you from being tripped up by religion. So he goes on to say, for the purpose of you closely examining and carefully considering so as to protect you from the woman who is evil, repulsive, and offensive, severing the relationship, raw. Raw is a bad, bad term. This is the raw isha. This is the whore of Babylon, and he's going to explain that in a moment. From the smooth and seductive, the slippery and flattering tongue of the treacherous whore, the Nakri. Well, this is the whore of Babylon. This is the very essence of religion. This is the seductive side of the adversary, Hasatan. So if you know the truth, if you're enlightened, you're not going to fall prey to religious and political schemes, no matter how seductive the speaker may be. You know, a lot of people think that Trump is articulate, and they just love his diatribes. There's others that would say the same thing about Bernie Sanders. Others would say the same thing about Hillary Clinton. Others would say the same thing about Ronald Reagan. Or I'm not sure anybody says that about George W. Bush, but be that as it may,
Adolf Hitler was a great speaker
and politician
and convinced the whole country to follow him.
Right.
Adolf Hitler was elected.
Politicians.
He didn't conquer.
Yeah. So moving on with other things that we learned from Yahweh, this happens to be in Mishal Proverbs 7, 1 and 2. It says, and remember now, the Proverbs are Dod, whom Yahweh said, he is my son and I am his father. Being inspired to write from the perspective of Yahweh, our heavenly father, and the Ruach Kodesh, our spiritual mother. And then speaking to their sons and daughters, those of us in the covenant. This is Yahweh speaking. My son, choose to closely examine and carefully consider. Boy, Boy, that's that word again, Shema.
There it is again.
There it is again. What do you think Yahweh, you want to know what Yahweh's will for your life is? Well,
yeah.
Well, how would you know
about one of Yahweh's seven favorite words?
Yeah, I think so. Shamar, be observant. Closely examine and carefully consider what I say. My answers, my explanations, my declarations, and my promises. Amir, what I say, how I provide answers, what those answers are comprised of. Closely examine and carefully consider my explanations and my promises. My son, choose to carefully and closely examine and consider what I say. My answers, my explanations, my declarations, and my promises. And the conditions of my relationship agreement, my mitzvah, you should habitually treasure and store within you. That's pretty good advice. And coming from someone I think we can trust, someone whom we've come to respect, whose words we cherish. Choose to keep focused upon and observe. Well, there's that same verb again. Shamar. Written in the call imperative. Choose of your own volition to literally keep focused upon and observe. Mitzvah. Once again, my instructions regarding the terms of the binding contract. And live. Be restored. Be renewed. My Torah teaching, Torah, should be as the pupil, the center and focus of your eyes and understanding. Absolutely essential. You want the Torah to be your focus. Isn't that precisely what it's saying?
Yeah, that's what Doe did.
Make it the focus of what you're observing, of what you're looking at, of what you care about. So that is precisely what is being said here. Make it the center of your focus. Observe it, care about it, learn from it. Then it says, those who neglect, who reject, who azab the Torah, arrogantly boast and make fools of themselves by extolling that which is wrong, unrighteous, and evil. So, one of the real advantages of being focused on the Torah is that by doing that, you're specifically able to avoid being arrogant, about making a fool of yourself, about being wrong. And that's the thing that, there's a good side. We can be right, which puts us in a relationship with God. Or we can be wrong, and if we're wrong, and we keep it to ourselves, that's not good. But if we're wrong and we boast and make fools of ourselves by extolling that which is wrong, well, then there's a horrible, horrible consequence of doing that. And that's what's being shared here.
Yeah.
But those who observe, focusing upon the Torah, they take the initiative to oppose and resist them. That destroys the myth of political correctness, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That you embrace and accept mutually opposing views, that we're accepting of man's ways, no matter how wrong they might be. God says, if you know the truth, you're going to oppose the lies. God does. You should follow his example. And this judge not, lest you be judged. It's nonsense. Actually reads by Credo, the Greek term, separate, and you will be separated. Separate from people from God, you'll be separated from God. That's what it actually says. But you know, if you're observant and you observe the Torah, then you're going to take the initiative to oppose those who resisted, who were opposed to the Torah. Evil individuals do not comprehend or impart good judgment. Well, if there was ever a term that encapsulates political correctness, this would be it, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Evil individuals do not comprehend or impart good judgment. Really profound. That's the antidote for political correctness. That whole concept of political correctness, which so permeates the education in the West, so permeates politics in the West, destroys people's ability to think, to be judgmental, to make good decisions, to be discerning, to be discriminating, to differentiate between right and wrong, good and bad.
Well, you know, can I just add that when we use the word evil and we look it up and it's raw, and you also find that it means you're on the wrong path and you find dysfunctional or not doing what you were not required to do, but doing what you were designed to do, it really doesn't matter whether it's a... If you view religion as, like Christianity as something as some nicety, or you view social secularism being fair in some way or something like that, it's the wrong path. If it's not, people just look at these and they kind of blow them off like, well, they're nice people. Or these people mean well and stuff. And it's just wrong. You just destroy everything. You destroy their souls. You destroy their lives. There's one correct path. I mean, I don't know how many times he has to say it through here. He's done it about four times now. And the miswash is the terms and conditions. So, anyway.
There's one correct path, and you have to be judgmental. You have to really think your way through it to have any chance of finding it. And ultimately, those that do find that, they will fight against, they'll push back against the corruption of political correctness.
Not only do you have to be judgmental, but it's a matter of what you're using as your basis for being judgmental. Yeah, it's what are you using to judge by? There are a lot of judgmental religious Christians out there who are using Paul's letters as their basis for judgment. That don't make that right. You know, they're paying attention to the wrong source. And their judgment is bad.
I've been told that somebody's trying to listen to the show that the 347-326-9553 line gets the available lines get taken up early and it becomes impossible to call on that line. JB, I think you know another line that also works that's not published on the site. What is that other number?
It's 563-999-3021. That's what I've had in use for the past 6-7 months now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you listen on that line, you might be able to get in. That's 563-999-3021, because a very significant number of people just listen live on the on that guest line. I think we just tap out the number of lines that the switchboard will allow. So those who diligently seek, consider and understand everything. That's my conclusion. That's really my conclusion. Is that, now I want to be a little bit careful here. I'm still in the romper room when it comes to a comprehensive understanding of dimensions of time, of what Yahweh was offering us in terms of life in the seventh dimension and the universe and how we will experience it in the fifth, sixth, and seventh dimensions. And even exploring his words and coming to understand everything that he is teaching us, we're all infants growing. And maybe we're making our way through our adolescent years and our teenage years, but we're still seeking. And I think we will seek for all of our lives. And that's why this is those who diligently seek Yahweh consider and understand everything. It is this process of seeking that causes us to understand everything that is important. But I think this gets us right back into the nature of Hebrew, where it doesn't say that we understand everything in the present tense. Because what would the purpose be of continuing to seek if you already understood everything? I think this suggests that if we have this attitude of continually seeking, that we will ultimately make the connections to consider and understand everything over time. And we have lots of time to seek and understand. So, this is about us understanding what we need to understand now to capitalize on the offer that God is making, so that ultimately we come to understand everything given eternity of time and being in proximity to the creator of the universe and exploring the universe and life with him. That is the purpose of eternity, of being part of Yahweh's family, of camping out with them, is ultimately to understand everything. Yeah, the Torah, God's guidance written inside of us, as he's promised to do when he returns, well, that was certainly going to enhance our understanding, isn't it?
Yeah. My God. Yeah. Of course, then he's going to make it real interesting. He's going to start over.
Yes. Yes, right. So we get to witness the new creation.
That's what we can find now, guys and ladies.
Yeah. The one who turns away his ear from hearing the Torah, then consequently his repulsive prayers, abhorrent requests, and errant means to resolve conflicts will be considered reprehensible and detestable. Well, that's the statement we have shared and paraphrased a number of times, that the religious just don't get, they say, I feel good about praying. I pray every day. I'm praying to God. You're saying that God doesn't listen to me? That's what I'm saying. I'll go one step further. Not only doesn't God listen to you and has never heard one of your prayers, if he were to listen, he would find them detestable.
I think the boy is...
That kind of blows away Paul's pray without ceasing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you're not Torah observant, if you're not loving and passionate about Yahweh's Torah teaching, if you, as all Christians do, as all Jews do with their rabbinic Talmud, as all Muslims do with their Quran, as all socialist secularists do with their enlightened man concepts and their propensity to rely on political solutions and political dictates. The one who turns away from hearing the Torah, who's just not interested in listening to what God has to say, those who turn away from Yahweh's teaching, consequently, their pleas are abhorrent. Almost everybody gets themselves in a position sometime where they say, God, if you're there, I need help. God finds that request reprehensible. Don't do it. To ask a God that you're not willing to even listen to, you're not willing to consider what he has to say, and you want to ask him for something, well, that's reprehensible. Don't you think it would be reasonable to listen to him first, to get to know him first, to care about what he has to say before you ask him to care about what you have to say?
Well, people don't want to reconcile their relationship with him. They want him to reconcile with them. You know, they want to keep what they've got, and then can you fix it?
Yes.
And I think some prayer would do it.
Yeah. Or they get themselves in a pickle, and they say, you know, I made a deal with God that they would, you know, cure my son, cure my daughter, help me through this this terrible time. Okay. You know, I would do this, that, and the other thing. Whether you found a solution or did not, God had nothing to do with it. And if he had listened to you, he would have found what you requested repulsive. And keep in mind, God is not omniscient. He's not omnipresent. He does not know what most people are doing or have done or will do. and he does not know what most people have or will say or think. There's no reason to know. It would be miserable for him to know. Most human thoughts, most human actions are either, would be either so boring as to have no redeeming value whatsoever, or they're repulsive in terms of some of the things we think and do. So God would have every incentive not to listen. And what he's saying is, should he listen, he's going to find what the preponderance of people say, and that would be 999,999 out of every 1 million, he would find it repulsive, detestable, tohu wabohu, disgusting.
Yeah, awesome. Disgusting.
Yeah. You know, associated with religious worship and idolatry, erroneous perversions, which confuse and leads astray. To be abhorred and detested forever, engaged in an abominable religious ritual while intoxicated. The one who misleads the upright and straightforward in the way of error and evil into his own pit, he will fall and be cast down. Now, this is the fundamental truth. Is if you observe the Torah and act upon it using good judgment, you're going to live forever with God. If you ignore it, the end of your life, you're simply going to fade away into oblivion. There's no heaven, there's no hell, there's no punishment, there's no pain, there's no reward. You've lived your life and it's just over. But if you turn away from God's teaching and you become arrogant and start blathering your own perceptions and mislead people because you're sharing your opinions which are wrong, and you mislead others, then God's saying that there's a consequence for that. You're going to be cast down. So you can be a victim of religion and there's no consequence.
Mm-hmm.
You promote religion and you'll be cast down.
You know, that makes the evangelical side of Christianity so dangerous.
Yeah.
Yes.
I spent a lot of time on these two verses, breaking them down, and I can safely say that you cannot translate this any other way. There is no wiggle room on these. Every one of those words are very precise.
Yes.
So, I can assure you, if you can, go ahead and do it and let me hear about it, because I couldn't do it. I went through everything I could find. Nothing. That's exactly what it says.
Yeah. So if you turn away from listening to Yahweh's Torah teaching, then consequently, your pleas, your requests, your prayers, your means to resolve conflicts will be considered reprehensible and detestable. The one who misleads the upright and straightforward in the way of error and evil into the pit, he will fall and be cast out. You're right. But those who are right and thus innocent will enjoy a good, generous, festive, and beneficial inheritance. I want to conclude today's program with just word pictures, 29:18. Without prophetic revelation, wicked people take charge and become unrestrained, leading the unaware to their death because they lack the ability to respond rationally. But he who actually observes and genuinely focuses upon the Torah walks along the path which gives meaning to life, and they receive the benefit. The world has been given far more prophetic revelation than it needs. The Torah, the Psalms, the Proverbs, the prophets. We have vastly more revelation than we need to understand to make the correct choice. I mean, look how little of it we've really translated. Okay, so it's maybe 15,000 pages that we've contributed to accurate, more accurate translations and understanding what Yahweh said, but that's still just small percentage of the total. God's given us far more than we need. But since most people don't even consider it, we live in a world without prophetic revelation, with 100 million people that care about what God said, that accurately translate his testimony and communicate it. And without that prophetic revelation, then wicked people take charge. You see, religions permeate the culture. Political schemes prevail. Military crusades. Wicked people take charge and become unrestrained. That's the history of mankind. Look at the disgusting civilizations of Babylon and Assyria and ancient Greece with all their duplicity and sexual perversion, and then of Rome, one of the most evil cultures of all humanity, and the Carthaginians and the Spartans. And the Roman Catholic Church and the Nazis and Pol Pot and his communist Mao Zedong, Lenin, Stalin, Hitler. Look at even in the New World with the Mayans and the Aztecs and the Incas.
Yeah.
And the sacrifice of young children and tearing people's hearts out as an offering to their bloodthirsty gods. Without prophetic revelation, wicked people take charge and become unrestrained, leading to their death because they lack the ability to respond rationally. I think that's the great gift that we have passed on to the world. We didn't create this gift. We're just conduits of the gift. Is that we've taken what Yahweh said seriously and translated it as accurately as we could and help people understand what is being said and being offered so that they can respond rationally. And many have. But without that revelation, no one can respond rationally. I think that's why Yahweh and Yahshua Isaiah tells us over and over again, I searched to find one person with whom I could communicate. One person with whom I could work. Couldn't find any. No, for a better part of 2,500 years, almost 3,000 years, 2,700 years for certainly, and maybe longer, Yahweh couldn't find anybody with whom to convey his message. He didn't even need to give us fresh revelation. He just wanted what he'd already said communicated accurately so people could respond intelligently. He couldn't find anyone to do it. That's sad. But that's what he's saying, is that without prophetic revelation, without the communication from God, without prophecy, wicked people prevail. They become unrestrained. And the consequence is death, because people don't know how to respond correctly, rationally. But he who observes and genuinely focuses on Shamar again, Shamar Torah, the source of teaching, instruction, direction, and guidance, walks along the path which gives meaning to life and receives the benefits. It's what provides our freedom, our enlightenment, our empowerment, our enrichment. It gives life meaning. It gives life purpose. It's the ultimate purpose of life. The ultimate source of meaning. The ultimate benefit and blessing comes from observing the Torah, observing what God had to say in terms of his guidance. Boy, I tell you what, you just listen to what he had to say, guys, and it's pretty darn difficult to come up with a justification for Pauline Christianity, or for Quranic Islam, or for Talmudic Judaism, or for socialist secular humanism. God is saying that observing the Torah is what gives life meaning. And the rest of humanity would say, no, listen to me, no, listen to this, no, but I, Paul, say. God says, you want to have a meaningful life, listen to what he has to say. Well, guys, as we transition from Kippurim to Sukkah, I want to bid everyone a wonderful and happy Shabbat. And may the Torah bring meaning to all of our lives. Happy Shabbat.
Happy
Good night,
Shabbat.
Happy Shabbat.
Good night.
Enjoy Sukkah next week.
Yes. Happy next week celebration. I think today of Sukkah. Good night, everyone.
Good night.